From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1974, when a community of people living in a remote Indonesian jungle made contact with the outside world for the first time. That is, anyway, how the story goes, and it is a remarkable story. The Korowai people live in the Indonesian province of Papua. There are between 3,000 and 4,000 Korowai people, and they have essentially resisted modernity, living without technology. They build and live in stunning tree houses, some of them 20, 30, 40 feet high. As tourism spread into their region in the 1990s, the Korowai people got a closer look at what they might have considered the materialistic Westerners. And Western visitors got a rudimentary look at life for the Korowai. You probably wouldn't be surprised to hear that many of the subsequent articles indicated that this was a population of humans living in a kind of suspended stone age. But it turns out both Westerners and the Korowai had misunderstandings about the other. Perhaps no one can speak more authoritatively about these misunderstandings than Rupert Stash. He first traveled to meet the Korowai in the 1990s. He spent more than 20 months living with the Korowai people. They allowed him to observe their daily lives and rituals. He was able to interview dozens of men and women. You can imagine how jarring it might have been for the Korowai to allow an outsider to spend so much time with them, and Stash has said that they were magnanimous and kind. When the tourism industry sprang up, he took the opportunity to study how both sides viewed the other, and today he's visiting Rochester to offer a public presentation about this rare community that continues to resist modern technology. His presentation is tonight, but first he's my guest in studio on Connections. Rupert Stash, welcome. Nice to have you here.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here.
All right, brief interruption from my colleague Elisa Orlando, who's in studio, as this week is flying by on this Wednesday. Hello.
Hello. It's pledge week, and no, I don't want to interrupt because I want to hear this great story, and I appreciate, Evan, that you are taking us from politics for the next couple of hours.
Well, so. We've had a lot of politics, and we're going to get back
politics.
To it tomorrow.
Absolutely, so, yeah. Absolutely. You've done a great job covering the election, as our whole news team has, but I'm going to really appreciate hearing this story, so thank you very much for bringing it to us. As you know, this is our fall fundraising campaign, and we really appreciate any pledge of support, especially those of you who have called in at various times or sent me an email or called in to say that you appreciate Connections with Evan Dawson. Evan and his producer, Megan Mack, and the team that works on Connections with Evan Dawson is truly a unique team, and this is a unique service, something that you will not have anywhere else in local media. We know how important this is to you, so we're asking you to give us a call and make a pledge of support for your public radio station in this program. You call us at 454-6300, or you can make a pledge of support right online at WXXI.org. So go ahead and do it that way. You can also make a pledge through your smartphone app. If you're getting ready to tweet some questions for this very interesting topic, then go ahead and make a donation and support your public radio station.
I have one thing to add to this little
Certainly.
Thing.
Certainly.
So after the show today, I always ask if I can spend an afternoon pitching. So I'm going to be, during All Things Considered, I'm going to be here.
Okay, great.
And I'm picking up my son today from school, and I'm bringing him back, and he may pitch a little with us today.
That would be great.
I said to him today, what would you say to listeners? And he said, I would say, he's four. He said, don't give money, because then my daddy won't have to go to work and I want him home with me.
Oh.
And I said, in an interesting way, that may be a better pitch.
That's right.
That's not a threat, but my son Reese thinks if you don't pitch, then maybe I won't come to work anymore. So that's all.
Really?
That's all.
That's great. We did have some people call in this morning who said their kids, a little older, 8 and 10, that they listen to NPR with their kids.
Yeah.
And that they like the fact that NPR is a little quieter and the thoughtfulness that goes into NPR
sure.
news. So we appreciate your support. And Reese, don't worry, we won't take your daddy away for too long. 454-6300. And now, Evan, back to you.
All right. Thank you, Elisa Orlando. We're talking to Rupert Stash about the Korowai people, and I told him before the hour began, I wanted to be very clear about a few things. First of all, I'm ignorant about all kinds of matters. It's impossible not to be. I hope that's fair, Rupert.
No problem.
And also, we want to make clear that in this kind of a conversation, there have been a lot of articles about the Korowai people since the 1970s, when they were quote-unquote discovered, which is a weird way to describe a community of human beings. But some of them have been kind of treated the Korowai people like a museum exhibit, as opposed to an actual community of remarkable human beings, which is what they are. And so we're going to try to do our best to keep that in mind for the hour. So Rupert Stash, first of all, you first kind of understood about the Korowai people, who they were, or heard of them when. Take me back to that.
I first heard of them in 1993 from, a television show.
There you go.
But also through networks of other anthropologists and academics who were knowledgeable about conditions in this part of the world, the island of New Guinea, which is the most culturally and linguistically diverse place in the world. And they specifically, I was interested in working in this western half of the island that's part of Indonesia. And they put me in touch with an ex-missionary and linguist who had studied the Korowai language and written a book that was at that time in manuscript about the language and social conditions there. And so I wrote them, and they sent me the book manuscript.
All right, so that was back in 1993. Let's try to clear up any history, the sort of fact or fiction. The stories like to say that until around 1970, the Korowai people themselves, again, a population that numbers 3,000 to 4,000, mm-hmm. living essentially in the rainforest in this province of Indonesia, might not have even been aware of the existence of other people. Fact or fiction?
I'd say fiction.
Okay.
So for starts, we don't know a lot about it, but in 1911, a Dutch military mapping expedition skirted the north edge of their land. And so some Korowai knew that happened, and there's stories of them sort of, they're, you know, looking and watching and staying and hiding and so on. But it was kind of a non-event for both sides. And then so too in the mid-30s, again, Dutch organized expedition by a gold mining company that wanted to get to a particular place to try to see if there was any alluvial gold. They went right across the middle of the Korowai area. All we know about that is that, again, Korowai stayed in hiding, sort of shot at them at night and hit one guy in the hand with an arrow, but just generally stayed away. And again, it was kind of a non-event for both sides. So that's interesting that those kind of histories disappear, and for the people, those of us, for Westerners interested in the society, they always want it to be first contact the first time.
Sure, but you want to claim that kind of credit. Right.
So, but then the other, the more sort of the broader issue I'd raise there too is that even if radical, there were no regular interactions with long distance strangers up until about the late 1970s. There was tons of engagement with people who were different from themselves and other categories of beings that were different from themselves. So they were really used to social relations across big gaps of difference. They just didn't know about cities and industrial capitalism and these other scales and kinds of human difference and the kind of society we live in. And that really started to be a regular part of their life experience in the 1980s.
In the 1980s. And so this population meets Westerners who visit in the 1970s and 1980s. And I think listeners may wonder, well, once the Korowai people understood that I guess technology, industrialism, materialism, those kind of things were out there, was there any pull on their part to explore it themselves, to either bring in those kinds of goods or products, or to travel more themselves?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, their first response was a kind of a repulsion and fear, and they assimilated outsiders and their technologies to sort of the monstrous dead. So basically the U.S. imagery of a kind of zombie apocalypse, that's what was happening, and they wanted those zombies to stay away. But even there was a kind of, even in the repulsion, there's a fascination of can't look away from how strange that is, and even being kind of attracted to it. So people would narrate very kind of mercurial or fast transitions they went through of being repulsed by a technology or a foreigner, but then absorbed by it, saying, no, that's our zombies. We want them. They could go through that transition very quickly. They live very spread out across the landscape, so different pockets of the community had this experience at different times, and it was very controversial among different people. But overall, there was a big sea change across the last several decades to initially wanting all these new things to stay away and not be a part of their life, to intensely embracing them and really wanting to have them. But again, that was that happened. A big part of how that has happened has been through their own sensibilities about social relations and their own, in their relations among themselves, striving for equality and realizing good things through exchange. So they would adopt, for example, clothing because their relatives had adopted clothing and wanted to be like them, or they wanted to get some clothing to give to their relative to show care for their relative and so on. So their paths of getting interested in wanting to have money and wealth and live like city people, for example, as at least an imagined idea, have been kind of through the fabric of their existing habits of how to relate to each other to begin with.
I was going to ask about that. You think about all the different cultural barriers that there may be for the Korowai people, and then understanding, you know, the people who they are meeting and encountering, not the least of which is wearing clothing. They don't really wear much in the way of clothing, and that's just sort of would be kind of an inconvenience if they would assume. So, but are they wearing clothing more often now? Is that a change?
Clothing's pretty much universal at this point, except when the tourists are around, and we can talk about that later. But
another fascinating. Okay, yeah.
But again, in clothing, just like as I was narrating earlier, clothing was definitely one of those things that was, again, a focus of fear and seemed very foreign. And then there was a gradual process of different people deciding it was really great and so on. I mean, just take back a step. They never lived without dress in the sense that there's all kinds of things that look like nudity to us, for example, but in fact are very careful modification and covering and ornamentation of bodily surfaces. And that was a very social process, socially motivated, just as clothing is for us in the sense that people did it because of how they looked to others, or they would only feel comfortable if they had coverage or certain kinds of ornamentation in the eyes of others. They have adopted clothing very widely now, and for a whole variety of reasons. But again, some of the pre-existing conditions for that rapid adoption are from their own culture. So, for example, when we have these ideas about what an idyllic kind of society this must be to live in, and there's lots of great things about it, but Korowai are like hypersensitive to being mocked by other people. They think every other relatives might all be mocking them all the time and so on.
Which you can understand.
Yeah. And so if you've kind of got that idea, then the idea of being able to close up your body and not be seen was very attractive. A lot of people sort of once they sort of realized you could do that, that was very appealing just from the point of view of hiding away and that nobody would be able to see you've got some little blemish or something.
Okay. Well, so let's work through a couple other points here and that Rupert just kind of just referenced, because when you read the articles, for example, on Twitter, I posted one this morning that just takes you to, I think, a piece from, I don't remember if it was Daily Mail or The Guardian, but a piece about the Korowai people. What you will often see is a couple of things. You see a lot of pictures, and in the pictures, there is what Rupert, again, as he so succinctly said, what we might describe as nudity. It's more traditional Korowai dress. Mm-hmm. But interestingly enough, maybe that's sort of still a put-on for when the cameras are there. Mm-hmm. Just as you will definitely see pictures of very high tree houses.
Yes.
One in particular towering above the canopy, remarkable treehouse, 140 feet in the air, but also many other structures that are very, very, very tall. And Rupert and I were talking before the program, and you said they do live in treehouses, but a lot of what they build there was just to impress tourists and Westerners.
Yeah. So in general, a normal Korowai elevated house is the floor would be about 15 feet above ground. And
not
families,
140, not 80, 100.
Yeah, still getting up there.
Oh, and, no question.
And still involving topping the trunk of a tree and building a kind of scaffold platform at quite a height. But it's true, that's just a slightly higher version of a kind of housing pattern that's widespread across the Southwest Pacific and Southeast Asia and so on, but a bit higher. But then also exceptionally in the past, young men typically would once in a while build just an ultra-high tree house up at canopy level, more to show off or to be able to pound the walls and make noise and people would hear it from far away, or above all, to see the beauty of the treetops. The forest landscape is very closed in general. There aren't sort of vistas overall, except where people make clearings, but even those are pretty small. And so it's just amazing sensory experience to get up above that canopy and see these long distances. But that was a rare thing, and nobody would actually live in one of those houses, which was completely impractical. And so then, for example, in the 1990s, when National Geographic photographers came and they published a story in 1996 that has this one most famous treehouse picture that you were describing, there was one of those ultra-high treehouses on the landscape and maybe, 1,000 other houses.
Sure,
but that one ultra-high one, which if you look closely at the photo, has been blown apart by the wind because it's so impractical to be up that high. That's the one that shows up in the magazine because it's just so amazing and so obvious that that's got to be the one to be published, and that's the one that just sort of defines who these people are. And
sure.
So then in the wake of that, other film crews go and other tourists go and want to see that house. And
yeah,
so Korowai build
show
that
us
house.
Your very high
that's right.
Houses. Yeah. And then, I'm just laughing because you think about this population of the Korowai people who are now starting to interact with tourists, with Westerners, National Geographic shows up. But are we really getting an accurate picture?
Mm-hmm.
If we're fixated on the one house above the canopy,
yeah,
and we share it with everybody, say, oh, look at this remarkable people. They live above the canopy. They don't live above the canopy. And I've read articles that say that they do.
Right.
So we can be misled, I think, by either one photograph or their desire to even please or impress visitors,
yeah,
leads us to not fully understand the experience. But you lived there. So 1995, you went there for 11 months. Is
mm-hmm,
that right?
That's true.
And you went there with what purpose in 1995?
Pretty open-ended. I had, as I mentioned, read this manuscript by some other people who had learned the language and sketched some things about social conditions there, and it just seemed very rich. So I went there with the goal of trying to understand how they thought about social relations. One thing I knew specifically was that they build these houses high up off the ground seems very impressive. What's to me even more striking is they live far apart from each other, and that's tied up with really emphasizing and valuing autonomy and not wanting other people to be around to tell you what to do and so on. So they vote with their feet and have these buffers of space between each other. So my basic goal was to understand what is social life under those conditions, or how do people value and make valued social relations when they're wanting to also keep their distance or hold on to their self-determination.
Talking to Rupert Stash, who's in Rochester, he's a lecturer in social anthropology at the University of Cambridge. He's the author of Society of Others, Kinship and Mourning in a West Papuan Place. And he is giving a lecture tonight at the University of Rochester. It's in the Lander Auditorium of Hutchinson Hall at the U of R at 7 p.m., 7 to 8. So if you are addicted to the idea of the third presidential debate, you've got time to get home and see it. And maybe you're not. Maybe you need a diversion tonight. But 7 to 8 is his lecture tonight. He's going to be discussing Dramas of Otherness, First Contact Tourism in New Guinea. That's free and open to the public. And when I found out that he was coming, I thought this would be a great discussion, primarily for the reasons you're hearing. Once in a while, you see these articles that describe this idea of, could there be a community of people on this planet who live not even aware of the existence of cities and technology and automobiles and airplanes? Does that still exist? And once in a while you see these stories that it does, or maybe it mischaracterizes, and we're getting much more of an accurate picture of this population that's been described in this way, this last bastion of sort of Stone Age ideal. And some of that is a slur, and some of that I think is this idealistic version of what life would be like, living in the rainforest, living away from modernity. So Rupert was there for 11 months, and the Korowai people, I want to kind of set the scene of where exactly it is. How do you get there from here? If you're traveling to where they live, how do you get there?
You need to fly across the Pacific somehow or other.
Yep.
And probably enter Indonesia in the western part of Indonesia, so Bali or Jakarta and Java. If in effect, you fly a huge spiral. So fly to western Indonesia, then fly all the way across to eastern Indonesia, the far eastern end of Indonesia, which is like flying across the whole United States, and get to a coastal administrative capital of the larger province, the west half of New Guinea, called Papua, as you mentioned, and take care of some things there. And then in the mid-90s, when I first went, the easiest place to go to was this ex-mission post at the very southwest edge of the Korowai area, where there was an airstrip. And so there are foreign missionaries active in different places across Papua, and there are aviation organizations that are also mission-run and mission-sponsored that aid them. And they helped me by giving me flights, charter flights, or just seats on other flights that they had for church personnel to this airstrip.
And when you get there, you have to deal with different cultural barriers, not the least of which is language. So on that first trip, how did you communicate?
I had already studied Indonesian, which is a lingua franca of the country at large. Korowai at that time, I would say maybe 5% of them, and only men, typically young men with a little bit of travel experience or experience in living in new kind of centralized village settlements, were conversant in Indonesian. And so for the kind of details that I needed to get into for understanding how Korowai actually experienced social life and expressed themselves and so on. I needed to learn their language. I had this grammar sketch that the previous linguist had put together, and so that was very helpful as a kind of analytic description of some important structural aspects of the language. But basically, it was an ideal language learning experience in the sense of I just had no choice. I put myself into these households where there was just monolingual Korowai speech all around me, and that was the only thing going on. And I just tried to be a sponge, and it was a frustratingly slow process, and my skills are, you know, really imperfect, but it was a really, at the same time, exhilarating experience to day after day have these new kind of rich forms of verbal expression coming into my awareness.
And they were generally welcoming to you?
Super welcoming, yeah. Super welcoming.
And how did you communicate, especially in those early months when you were still working on the language, and you might have had questions about daily activities, about meals, those kind of things? How did you end up communicating?
Well, probably the most important thing to say is communicating through objects is just a huge thing in this society, among themselves and with outsiders like me. So even when, you know, there's this awkward foreigner who doesn't know how to act right and can't understand the most basic expressions, giving of food, giving of things that I could bring from town, like fishing line and fishing tackle or money or things like that, is a very primordial kind of solidarity-making kind of activity. So that was a basic kind of communication that was going on all the time. I was never also, despite what I said earlier, I always had a friend with me who, a Korowai friend who could speak some Indonesian as well. And so a typical pattern for me would be to spend all day sitting with this or that person or following a small group of people in their activities and sort of being a bit of an annoyance and trying to understand what they're saying and asking them to repeat things and so on, but also just jotting down a list of all the things I didn't understand but I could catch the form of. And then I talked to my friend in the evening, sometimes using Indonesian, and he would set me straight on the things I hadn't understood. So that was always there as a resource also.
You lived in their tree houses, is that right?
Yeah, that typically. I mean, again, it would depend. There's several different kinds of architectural forms. They build ground-level houses as well, and they build a style of house that's just a couple feet above ground. But my favorite kind of living condition would be one of those ones that was, I mentioned earlier, that's quite a bit above ground, 10, 15 feet, catches a nice breeze up there. They build them with an open balcony or a veranda on each end, and to my taste, that was a really nice kind of space. So I would sort of have a little camp set up on one of those verandas in a family's house. And then typically also, if in the same garden clearing, there might be another ground level day shelter that somebody had built just for this or that activity, I would kind of often take that over or kind of rent that as a space for sitting with people and talking and trying to improve my language skills.
What were the bedding or sort of sleep accommodations?
I took with me a little like plastic sleeping mat, and I had a mosquito net that I would put over me, and so that was a kind of almost private, cozy room space that I would sleep under myself. They sleep around fires, so they have these hearths in the inner spaces, the inner room-like spaces of the house that people would sort of sleep around. And they would build those up a bit through the night just to stay warm themselves. But I felt plenty warm. I would have a cloth with me that would keep me warm as well. And it's pretty funny. People, lots of activity through the night. People wouldn't think anything of getting up in the middle of the night and having a very animated conversation while other people are sleeping and so on.
Okay. Well, do they get regular 8 hours, or is it a different sleep schedule?
Yeah, they get a regular 8 hours. People would turn in earlier. It's a kind of, there's not much of a seasonality, and it's a very getting dark at a little after 6 o'clock and getting a light a little before 6 o'clock. Real regularity to that. But yeah, people are typically turning in by 8 or 9 and up, getting up by 5, something like that.
I was just thinking the other night, there was such a clear moon, and I was walking in a place that and I was walking in a place where there wasn't much in the way of electricity.
Right.
And I thought, you know, this is the kind of night where hundreds of years ago, this would have been quite a convenience to have a beautiful clear moon like this.
Yes.
I even remember reading the story of John Wilkes Booth's ride after the assassination and how he was aided by a clear moon and how valuable that could be when you're traveling. And so how much did you have to get used to the notion of not seeing electric lights and you know, various forms of just illumination?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, just at a practical level of doing anthropological research, I needed some kind of illumination, even just to get a couple more hours out of the day in the evening to, for example, be able to write down what my friend was telling me when I was asking him those evening questions about what that person said such and such related. Really, I didn't understand it. So I was a little bit of an artificial, you know, I could have some access to kerosene lamp or other kinds of lantern devices that I would have with me, but I'd always be struggling to make those things work and so on. So I created my own modified bubble of a compromise between everything and nothing. They're huge fans of the new forms of illumination they could get. I mean, they again, previously disliked darkness in some ways. It has negative connotations of people doing invisible bad things behind their backs and so on, or it just limits what they could do because they'd like to be able to do things at night, for example, like somebody killed a pig just in a trap right at the end of the day. They really want to take a bunch of it to their relatives in different directions, so they come ask to borrow my flashlight or ask to borrow somebody else's flashlight who's got one. So from their point of view, boy, if we could just light this place up, that would be great.
Well, Rupert has given that presentation tonight, and I just realized I'm late for a break. We're talking about his work with the Korowai people, and that's K-O-R-O-W-A-I. In an Indonesian province in the rainforest, this population of 3,000 to 4,000 people, you might have seen articles over the years, over the past 30 to 40 years, they have been publicized in National Geographic, film, and other places. You know, this kind of the stereotypical holdouts against modern technology. And we're learning much more of the real story of the Korowai people from Rupert and his work. You can hear him tonight at the University of Rochester. It's the Lewis Henry Morgan Lecture, and that's tonight from 7 to 8 o'clock tonight. It's free. It's open to the public at the U of R. That's in the Lander Auditorium of Hutchinson Hall. Let's get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back and talk about as tourism came to the Korowai people. And I'm wondering if Rupert thinks that that's sort of, I use the word gauche, or I wonder if tourism is gauche to come view these people, or is there a benefit to this kind of primitivist tourism, as he calls it? We'll talk about that and much more about what we're learning from the Korowai people next. Coming up in our second hour, we talk to Ward Stair, the music director for the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra, and Alan Fletcher, who's the president and CEO of the Aspen Music Festival. He's a composer himself, and we're talking about American composed music, American classical, if you will, or orchestral music. Why don't we really understand and appreciate American music like we do European music? That's next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Rupert Stash spent about 21 months or so over a number of years, but the longest stretch with the Korowai people was an 11-month stretch in 1995, and that's what he's describing to us. And I asked about the darkness, about living in a place in the rainforest where technology and modernity has not reached. And it's one thing to talk about the darkness. It's another to talk about the sound. And you said that well, in many ways, you get to hear a lot of the world uninhibited. I would think it's beautiful. What was it like?
Yeah, I found it just a very beautiful place to be. I mean, the forest alone, the forest environment was just magnificent, just this profusion of all kinds of different vegetation. But also the bird sounds, for example, were just amazing in the morning, in the evening, and so on. And I mentioned earlier that a lot of the spaces of the site are very closed in. You know, you're walking in the forest or you're in a clearing, but there's this wall around you. And people, they are paying attention to things in sound as much as sight. And so, for example, it's a really strong convention in the society that just when you're approaching some other people's where they live, you know, you weren't able to phone them up to let them know you're coming or something like that, you start singing on approach to the clearing so that it's not a surprise or a shock to them when you suddenly break into the clearing. And if you didn't, it would sort of, again, convey this possible connotation that, well, maybe you were sneaking around and trying to sneak up on them or just come steal their string bags or something like that. So people are very, it's a really fun kind of gregariousness and just sort of saying, hey, we're here, we're coming, but in this very sung kind of manner.
All right, so this is, I've got a short list of rote basic questions I think people would normally have when you talk about living among a community of people that is very remote. So number one, how was the food?
It was great. People took really good care of me. Again, I mentioned earlier that a lot of the relating through is through objects, so the food sort of kept me alive, but it was also part of the research and learning how to give and how to buy from people and give back to them and so on. There were plenty of foods that I didn't really like a lot, but there's enough different foods that there'd be some that I really liked, such as pretty steady supply of freshwater shrimp or crayfish that were just completely delicious. And their staples foods are pretty starchy, so they make banana gardens with these types of bananas that you roast on a fire and then eat, very bland. And sago starch, the starch that's produced from a palm tree, is the biggest staple food. And again, it's just a very basic starch staple that people make a kind of unleavened bread from by roasting on fires. And so it's a kind of environment where, in general, people aren't hungry. Those staples are always there, and then it's just a matter of what other kinds of greens and fish and so on are available.
I'm going to stress again all kinds of ignorant questions.
That's fine.
But do they eat together? Is there one meal a day that they would perhaps eat together? Do they consider a breakfast, lunch, dinner the way we do, or is that sort of not how they view food?
It's a little more opportunistic and flowing. People are going to typically eat as part of the morning routine in a house, eat sometime during the day, even if they're out and about. They may have taken something with them or have gotten something out and about that they're from their garden that they're going to eat out in a camp somewhere, and then eat again as part of the nighttime routine. I mean, what people do on a typical day is get food from their garden, so on and so forth, and bring it back to their house. And so nighttime is maybe the hopefully typically biggest meal of the day, but also I just can't emphasize enough that social relations and eating are just the same thing, and people are constantly opportunistically, if they had a windfall or they got some kind of nice food, they're constantly thinking, who can I give this to, who can I share it with, and when it's there to give and to share, that's when you prepare it and eat it. So if that's 10 in the morning, then you do it then. If it's 3 in the afternoon, you do it then, and so on.
You mentioned the treehouse is 10, 15, maybe 20 feet high. Some of them that they can build are higher.
Mm-hmm.
And you're getting up onto them how?
The normal thing is there's a notched ladder pole at each end, maybe 5 inches in diameter, with these notches cut into it every foot or two, about a foot and a half apart each rung, I guess. And
how'd you feel about that?
I got more used to it. The people who took care of me, my hosts, you know, they would be nervous about it and point out to me ladder poles that were not adequate for somebody heavy like myself.
Seem heavy, but
to their eyes, I'm just gigantic. You know, I'm 5'6", but to them, that's it's not so much the height, but the bigness of body. Just a, you know, not even a heavy set Westerner looks to them kind of giant. And again, that may be both true physically, but it's also just something they might exaggerate in their own mental image of the outsiders.
So they looked out for you anyway.
They did, yeah. And so, I would try to be careful. I mean, they could climb up and down these things with very amazing kinds of loads and helping their kids and their dogs and the firewood and everything. And I would just try to get myself up and down safely and so on.
Okay. You mentioned that you slept with a mosquito net. Are they just more used to that sort of environment? Do they have issues with that at all?
They have a lot of difficulties with illnesses, and malaria would be the single biggest mm-hmm. one. Some medical professionals have been through and been really, I mean, in general, communities in across New Guinea, especially the lower elevation parts, have trouble with malaria, but infection rates among Korowai are especially hard, and that's one source of mortality. There are forms of immunity or lessened susceptibility that come with long-term exposure to the microbe, but no, health is a huge issue for them, and the realities of life and death and bodily vulnerability are just a huge part of their mental world.
Do they have doctors?
They have healers who would try to fix afflictions by kinds of invisible processes of taking things out of people's bodies that they thought were foreign objects that maybe are thought to be in their bodies, and they would kind of use a religious image of a medium of a spirit familiar who could help them get some foreign object out of somebody's bodies. And they have some kinds of leaves that they use for pain relief or as internal medicines for certain kinds of afflictions and so on. But again, overall, I think they feel themselves to be vulnerable to the world and vulnerable to forces outside their control as far as their health well-being.
Political structure, any hierarchy, how does that work?
Yeah, that's one of the most interesting things is they're really opposed to hierarchy. And so if anybody tries to tell somebody else what to do, you would just say, you know, who are you to tell me what to do? I'm moving away. And so there were no named political offices in the society. One of our stereotypes of this kind of society is, you know, they have tribes and the old people are wise and people listen to the old people and so on. They have tribal chiefs.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And that just doesn't obtain. It's a very egalitarian society in the sense of not necessarily that everybody's equal, but that they want to be equal, and especially they're opposed to authority.
So what is the authority of, say, a home? Are the parents of children, are children living with the parents until an average certain age? Are mostly treehouses family structures? How does that work?
Yeah, that's a great question. One thing I should say is that they have the biggest institution in their society is a system of land ownership. There's these named groups that people belong to by who their father is, so they're patric clans. They're very small groups, but that group is associated with a specific place on the landscape, like a square mile of forest. So they live spread across 500 square miles of land, and that's a huge patchwork of all these different little clan territories. There's a really strong sense of people being owners of specific patches of the land. And so people are not super comfortable being on the land of that they don't own, or that's not the land of their close relatives, for example. So people, their houses, they typically build them on land they own or land of their close relatives. Children grow up on that land. They may move to other land when they get married, or if one of their parents dies and the other parent remarries and moves somewhere else or something. There's a lot of shuffling going on, and households change composition a lot over time. But yeah, most of the time, there'd be a married couple with some kids that would be a kind of core part of the households. But even very quickly, those kids start to have a lot of autonomy. One of the sort of biggest fights I ever saw was a mother telling her maybe 9-year-old child, no, you can't go 5 miles off with your uncle to go to this place that you want to go to. I'm worried about your well-being there. You need to stay here. And this kid just threw the hugest tantrum I've ever seen, because kids, even at this very early age, are encouraged to express their autonomy, be able to cook for themselves, be able to make decisions for themselves, travel on their own, and so on. So they tend to stay under the care of their parents, but they have relatives, uncles, and so on and so mm-hmm. forth, all kinds of places that they'll orbit around, and it's no big deal for them to go sleep with their aunt, their uncle, their cousin, just as a regular part of their daily life.
Is there crime?
Yes, there's theft, for example. So I mentioned equality earlier, and part of how that works is that if people see somebody else who has something, or they just feel that somebody else, there's an imbalance, they've done something and they didn't invite me, or I was there, I had rights to that sago grove and they used it for something else, going back to some history in the past where they don't recognize that I was part of that group, but actually I was, something like that. If there's a kind of feeling of imbalance and asymmetry, and you try to persuade people to fix it and they don't, then you go steal from them, for example, as a kind of way to compel balance again. And they'll even do things, so you might go kill their domestic pig, or a really, you know, big act would be to go burn down their house or something like that. It doesn't happen very often, but when it does, people talk about it and it becomes part of, you know, past knowledge and so on. And that's a really marked kind of bad action. People speak of it as invisible acting. Theft is so a thief is somebody who has invisibility, meaning they go about doing things behind people's back. And it's a really kind of negative moral archetype. But it's there as part, it's a kind of integral part of that system of trying to have an egalitarian social order that I mentioned.
And how would they deal with a thief then?
Well, they, one thing they might do is just define that person as a thief, like collective kind of gossip, and a certain kind of ostracism, not in the sense of, you know, necessarily kicking the person out of the community or even doing violence against them or something like that, but just it becoming a reputation that that person is a thief. And when they're around, we should keep track of, you know, watch your objects. That person is a thief. But more, but more than pathologizing specific people, I suppose the normal thing that would happen, if it's not just somebody who's fallen into the habit of that kind of action, is, again, to try to fix the situation. I think why it's kind of normal for to go do kill somebody's pig or something like that is people understand that in turn to be an invitation to fix the problem. There's a kind of political principle that works for them sometimes that's along the lines of, if you don't know how to solve a problem, make it bigger. Like, go do something. You've got a conflict or a feeling of imbalance with somebody. They're not answering the way you feel they should. You go do something against somebody else, which draws them into the problem. That other person now is mad at the original person also. And so that sort of forces people, okay, let's sit down and fix this by, you furtively killed that pig. Now we're going to, in the open, kill another pig and share it and give it to the person whose pig was killed, that type of thing.
Interesting. Talking to Rupert Stash, lecturer in social anthropology at the University of Cambridge. He's the author of Society of Others, Kinship and Mourning in a West Papuan Place. And he's giving a lecture tonight at the University of Rochester from 7 to 8 tonight on the subject of dramas of otherness, first contact tourism in New Guinea. So let's kind of close our hour with that here. This is, there are all kinds of stereotypes about this, you know, this exotic group of people who, as the world developed into the industrial age, they never came out of the rainforest, and they maybe not even aware that cities exist and that they're out there and that there's 3,000 to 4,000 of them. What are the stereotypes that were wrong that tourists maybe had? Take me through what sort of the Westerners and what tourists would be wrong about the Korowai, and what the Korowai were wrong about when they sort of encountered tourists in the West.
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I mean, the single biggest thing that I'd say we Westerners have been wrong about are that these people are archaic or unchanging, or that there's a single type of people and they're basically the same everywhere. They live in tribes, they're socially uniform, they have chiefs, they have villages. There's this very generic image of an archaic kind of society that we think of as the past of humanity or something like that. And that's actually a little piece of our culture and our imagining, and we're probably thinking about and symbolizing things about our own social world through that little piece of conventional wisdom, and it just doesn't really correspond to anything out in the world. So I'd say change is constant in this society, the specific society that I've studied, and people are constantly engaged with new things and different things than they're used to. And so I'd say that's maybe the biggest area of mistaken expectation.
Despite this idea of an unchanging society,
right,
going back to the Stone Age.
Yeah,
okay. So
exactly.
Change does happen for the Korowai.
Constantly.
Not in the way that we're used to, but change,
right,
happens. Okay.
Yeah.
And what did they think of, especially when they started in the 1990s encountering Western tourism, as you called it, this primitivist tourism, the people who would come and have a chance to at least, I think, experience a meal and maybe see some of the structures.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What did they experience, or what did they think of the tourists?
Well, the thing they've come to think is that, so the big paradox of the tourism situation is that the Westerners go thinking, wow, this is amazing. This is a people who live in immediate harmony with their surrounding environment, and they just get their livelihood directly from nature. And that's the best way you could possibly live, is they just don't have consumer goods and money and market situations.
And pollution.
Korowai have come to think, they see the tourists come and they think, wow, these are people who just live in immediate harmony with their surrounding environment. They live in these cities where there's just endless piles of money and consumer goods, and every time they want to eat something, they just eat it. It's right there, and it's just there again, ready-made. They don't have to produce it, and that would be just the best possible way to live, is with all those piles of articles. So each side is looking at the other and seeing that as just the ideal exotic condition that you could ever possibly live in, and totally happy and unalienated. It gets against the difficult, fragmented life that we live. And so... So that's kind of the funny thing, is that, and the mistake maybe that Korowai have gotten themselves into, is thinking that capitalist, industrial, consumer culture, giant life of urban jobs and articles and so on is
there's
is,
no struggle.
There's no struggle. There's no poor people. There's no. It's not. It's yeah.
Okay. And when it comes to that primitivist tourism, are you comfortable with it?
I feel like I have to be at some level, because Korowai are. They've become very pro-tourist, so I don't feel I can sort of come out and say categorically, this is wrong. Because part of my job is to understand what their what they want and what their ideas are. I think I'm against a lot of the stereotypy, and I'm against kind of tourism that would involve... going this incredibly long distance to meet what's basically a symbol of yourself that you're not recognizing as just something you want from your own society. So the more it could ever be a tourism that's actually kind of interactive and finding out that, oh, hey, these people actually really like clothing, or finding out things about their own struggles and their own ways of relating to each other, I think that's probably a better thing. Yeah, I think that the stereotypy, the big negative stereotype we have about tourists in general, and this kind of tourism specifically, is that that's just a sort of human zoo kind of situation. Putting these people on display, it's very dehumanizing of them. It's very voyeuristic of sort of putting yourself as a separate category from the world you're observing, and it's very sort of hierarchical and even violent in these kind of slightly disguised ways and so on. And I think that's true, or something to be sensitive to or wonder, is this specific tourism that I'm doing or that I'm witnessing here kind of organized on those ways. At the same time, we have to remember that just as Korowai or tribal archaic humanity is a big loaded stereotype in our society and it's part of our culture, so too is the figure of the tourist as a kind of bad moral archetype. And so there may be a quickness of jumping to the conclusion that that's what's going on here also, that's actually tourists are themselves complicated and worried about, am I participating in an unethical human zoo kind of situation?
Yeah, okay. Well, just over a minute left here, and I think the mistake would be to ask you to draw some grand sweeping conclusion about the interaction of, you know, the West and the Korowai, or the outside world, so to speak, in the Korowai. And I don't want you to do that, but I would, if you wanted to just share with us one insight that you really think you've gained that 20, 25 years ago you didn't have before you met and interacted with the Korowai people.
Oh, that's a tough one. I would say The big one that I didn't know when I started that PhD research and really learned in my first years of research were just that they really, like everybody, are struggling with difference between each other in their everyday social lives, and making that sort of the basic path of having relations, is working on difference, working on separation, working on their political differences, and so on. And that, which is to say, they're not a sort of uniform, homogeneous community of people who all think alike and just feel we are the Korowai tribe. Actually, they're this complicated, heterogeneous, differentiated world of tumult and making and breaking of bonds.
When's the last time you were there?
2011. I hope to go back next year.
Oh, very good. Well, I appreciate your spending the hour with us here. And again, if you want to hear more about Rupert's experience and especially Dramas of Otherness, First Contact Tourism in New Guinea, if this is interesting to you and you're listening to this and you think, I know who would love this, you got a chance tonight, 7 p.m., free and open to the public at the University of Rochester. It's at the Lander Auditorium of Hutchinson Hall. And his name is Rupert Stash. Thank you so much for being here and learned so much from you. We really appreciate it.
Oh, it was a real pleasure.
All right, short break. Much more Connections is next.